haven't written fiction since I wrapped up my girls series, but as often happens when you're in the middle of writing a book, I started daydreaming about my next book. This happens partly because you're deep in a creative headspace and mostly because writing books, no matter how many you do, is super hard. Fantasizing about being finished and working on the next thing is the carrot you dangle to get you through big writing days. So this new novel, it's my carrot, and I got excited enough to tell Dave about it. And in doing so, I opened myself up for opinions. His opinion was that the plot sounded a lot like something else, and that it also sounded a little convoluted. He said it in the nicest way, truly, just as a harmless thought as part of our little brainstorming session. The problem is not that he offered his opinion. The problem is that I immediately started to adjust my thoughts about the book. I immediately started to wonder if maybe he was right and my idea was wrong and I should just scrap it. But the truth is, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if Dave is right. It doesn't matter if the experts are right. It doesn't matter what anyone else thinks or believes. The idea, the dream, the goal is my own. The second I start looking for other people to validate it, I begin to lose steam and momentum. When you're in the early stages of an idea or a goal, you're the most insecure, which means you're easily swayed by what other people might think or believe. You're most easily talked out of an idea you might have loved or into an idea you might regret when you allow other people's opinions to color your plans. It's like when you ask someone to review or critique the first draft of your manuscript when you're only halfway done. When I ask someone to read an unfinished draft, it's because I'm looking for validation. It's usually because I'm struggling and thinking I'm a terrible writer, and I want someone whose opinion I admire to tell me to keep going. The truth is, no one else can validate you enough to finish a first draft. No one can validate you enough to follow through on the dream you've laid out for yourself. Even the most encouraging coach on the planet can't make you finish the race. You're going to have to find it in yourself to chase it down all on your own. But what's the harm, right? If you still finish it yourself in the end, why does it matter whether you look for someone else to validate your idea in the beginning? Because while other people can't help you finish, they can certainly, even if unintentionally, talk you out of trying. I wish I could just snap my fingers and make it so that you no longer felt trapped under the weight of other people's opinions and expectations, but I know it's not that easy. It's a hard habit to break, but make no mistake, it's a habit and a choice. We can choose to not allow that weight in our lives. But since we're all probably operating under some negative opinions, we also need to learn how to get out from under what is already there. And that starts with understanding exactly what kind of opinions we're dealing with. Here's the deal. There are two kinds of negative opinions, substantiated and hearsay. Substantiated means that you know for sure the negative opinion is there. Someone tells you the things they don't like about you, straight up to your face like a Drake song. Maybe they're family, maybe they're friends, maybe they're random strangers on the internet. These kinds of substantiated opinions are delivered two possible ways. Just follow me down this road. I promise we're going somewhere. The first possible presentation of a negative opinion is thoughtful and kind. It's given to you by someone who cares about you, and they're concerned about a choice that you're making. But even when their heart is in the right place, there's a lot of nuance here. Is this really about you? Or is their concern grounded in their perception that what you're doing is wrong? Remember our conversation about other people's perceptions of what's shameful. The other way you might possibly hear someone's negative opinion about you is in a hurtful way. This is when whoever is offering the opinion, family member, friend, stranger, doesn't come with the intent to offer constructive feedback or to help you get better or to show you true concern. Their intent is to tease you and belittle you at best, or tear you down and hurt you at worst. Either way, ain't nobody got time for that. This person's behavior does not have a place in your life. Let me say it again. This behavior doesn't have a place in your life. I don't care if it's coming from your sister or your mom or your boyfriend. Nobody deserves verbal and mental abuse, and every time you allow it to happen, you're giving that person permission to treat you that way. You are not required to put up with it just because you always have. To recap, we've got two kinds of negative, substantiated opinions. The first comes from a place of love. So you're going to be a grown-up and consider it, but not accept it as gospel truth unless it feels right to you. The second isn't meant to be helpful, but destructive, and therefore you should reject it. Reject it! Don't let it be considered, discussed, absorbed, or given one single particle of oxygen to help that fire spread. Any opinion not presented in love should not be considered, period. Which brings me to the second kind of negative opinion about you, the hearsay, the figment of your imagination. No matter how likely it may be, the negativity that you've made up all on your own. Eleanor Roosevelt told us that nobody could make us feel bad without our consent. I'm going to add to that. Be very careful you're not consenting to let your mind make you feel bad when nobody else actually did anything. What do I mean by that? Perhaps you're pretty sure your mother-in-law disapproves of you, or you're almost positive that your cousin Crystal's snarky comment on Facebook was aimed in your direction. Maybe you know for a fact that the girls you went to high school with, who you now know only through social media, would make fun of you if they saw you trying to do something new. In all of these instances, none of these negative opinions are actually substantiated, and therefore, you're really just sabotaging yourself. Nobody has said anything. Nobody has done anything. Maybe your new mother-in-law does disapprove of you. And maybe she just misses her son and feels anxious about how she'll fit into your life. Maybe your cousin Crystal was aiming that comment in your direction, but you and I both know that Crystal is the worst. She used to give you titty twisters. This is the person whose opinion you're going to worry about? The irony is, most of the time, nobody is actually thinking about you. Nobody actually cares what you're up to. And if they do, they're not judging you or making fun of you behind your back. It's not like you hang out with a bunch of ogres, right? And if they do dislike you, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. But more than that, assuming that someone thinks the worst of you when you have no real evidence to back that up isn't about them. It's about you. You're letting their opinion control your life, and you don't even know if they really have one. It's all in your own thoughts. You're just wrapping it up and blaming it on other people so you don't have to take responsibility. The truth is, it doesn't matter what they think of you. It matters what you think of you. Hard as it is to reconcile, someone else's opinion only holds power if you allow it to. If you actively take steps and intentionally begin to live without obsessing over what other people think, it will be the most freeing decision of your life. Excuse 9. Good girls don't hustle. I'm a hustler, baby. Jay-Z. Don't you hate it when an author starts a chapter with a quote? As a longtime book nerd, I have read approximately 70,000 novels, and the quote thing has always felt a little self-aggrandizing to me. Like, oh, just read this elegant prose from Tennyson and prepare yourself for a similar level of talent. It's even more annoying when the quote in question has literally nothing to do with the chapter you're reading. no thing. And you find yourself wondering, is this esoteric? Am I supposed to understand the correlation between a Whitman quote and this dragon shapeshifter love story? You would be shocked to know how many books about vampires falling in love with single moms or aliens falling in love with librarians start each chapter with a random quote. Yes, I read horrendously cheesy romance novels. Stop judging me. The point is, I hate chapters starting with quotes, but this chapter was the bonus in the last book. Shout out to all of you who snagged the Hustlers edition. And I loved it so much and felt like it was such an important topic that it gave me the idea to write this book. So we're going to start with the most iconic line on hustling I can think of, a Jay-Z lyric. A bonus chapter is like Equestria or a Kardashian birthday party. Anything can happen here. So I'm bringing in Jay-Z lyrics just for my gals who are chasing down a dream, who want something more and aren't afraid of hard work and audacious goals. Let's talk about hustle. I have been an overachiever for as long as I can remember. I was a dreamer from the very beginning. I would imagine elaborate scenarios my future grown-up self would be part of. I knew what my mansion would look like, could foresee the vacations I'd take, the prince I'd marry, and the horses I'd own. Horses because, well, I was 7, and having my own horse was the ultimate fantasy. I was going to name her Calliope, and I'd only ride her wearing the special tan pants that rich, equestrian-inclined girls wore in Lifetime movies circa 1991. A little girl daydreaming isn't anything unique, but perhaps what was unique was I knew even then that I could achieve anything if I was willing to work for it. I don't remember anyone ever saying that to me. Maybe I just understood it through observation and osmosis. When you grow up in a home that struggles financially, it doesn't bother you until you're exposed to the opposite. I realized at a very young age that there were people who didn't live paycheck to paycheck, who didn't scream at each other over money, who could walk into Target and buy anything they wanted. I was 11 when my goals for my future solidified. My parents had broken up again. It happened so many times over the course of my life, I honestly cannot tell you what number it was that time. The difference in this particular instance was that my mom decided to move out, and she insisted I come with her. Nobody asked me what I wanted or gave me a say in the matter. They simply announced that it was happening. My 3 older siblings would stay with my dad in our family home, and I would move into a crappy apartment with my mom. It was one of the darker years of my childhood. I rarely had access to my siblings, and the financial strain of parents who were now dividing resources to pay for 2 places to live meant that we had even less than before. I have a photo from that time of my 11th birthday party with a handful of friends from school in this rundown, shabby apartment. I can remember being embarrassed. I remember the boxed cake mix baked in an old Pyrex. I remember that we couldn't afford decorations. I remember being hyper aware of 2 things. First, I didn't want the kind of life where I lacked the funds for special occasions. Second, it's not very convincing to assert your independence, from my mother in this case, if you don't have the financial means to back it up. I vowed to myself that day that I would be wealthy when I grew up. It was my birthday candle wish. I stood in that tiny dining room on stained carpet in front of the yard sale table, and I promised myself something better. I will never live like this when I have the ability to prevent it. I was vehement in this. Someday, I would be rich. I'm not supposed to say that, I know. Social media is filled with hundreds of male CEOs and self-made entrepreneurs who tout the power of wealth and the justification for achieving it. But if you're a woman, it's frowned upon. It's impolite. It's not something good girls do. Good girls don't talk about money, and they certainly don't claim it as a life goal, regardless of their reasons why. What I learned in childhood, you get what you get and you don't throw a fit. That meant I should be happy with whatever life handed me, gracious and thankful for whatever came my way. But what was coming my way as a child and later as a teenager was a mostly crappy existence. And because I was a child, I couldn't do anything to change it. But I knew after that birthday party that the second I was in control, I would never be forced to settle again. There is a big difference between gratitude for your life and blind acceptance of whatever comes your way. I wanted more. I wanted more than I had grown up with. I wanted more access. I wanted more experiences. I wanted more knowledge. I wanted more challenges. I wanted more influence. I wanted the ability to help others who were in difficult financial places because I knew exactly how they felt. I understood even then that monetary resources would make that possible. I wanted so many big, grandiose things. When I was a child, people thought it was adorable. They'd pat me on the head and tell me how precious it was. But in my early 20s, I quickly learned what was and wasn't acceptable to my family, friends, or husband. When I started my own company, everyone saluted my moxie. But 2 years later, when I was pregnant with my first child, people immediately asked when I would be quitting. The business, they concluded, was just this cute thing I was doing to keep myself busy until my real calling started, being a stay-at-home mom. It's worth stopping right here to qualify that statement. I sincerely believe there is no harder job and no more important job than being a stay-at-home mom. I have so much stinking respect for my stay-at-home mom friends, and I'm not for one second implying otherwise when I tell you that it's just not for me. Next to my husband, my children are my greatest blessings. But y'all, if I had to stay home with them full time, I'm not entirely sure any of us would survive. It's not my spiritual gifting. It's not in my wheelhouse. You know what is in my wheelhouse? Building a successful business, managing a team, writing books, giving keynote speeches, crushing it on social media, strategizing, branding, PR, and planning live events where 1,000 women fly in from all over the world to be inspired. But at the time, none of those things were proven. I was still new to business. I only had an idea in my heart and a fire in my belly. I was figuring out how to run a business using books at the library and Google. I asked 100,000 questions to anyone who could offer wisdom. It was slow going at first, but dude, I was going. I got my first client and I worked my butt off. I treated that one single client like they were the last opportunity I'd ever get. I didn't have money, I didn't have a ton of experience, but I did have an unmatchable work ethic and I let it shine. I got the next client based on a referral from that first one. I did events for basically nothing in order to build up my portfolio. I took on any client I could find. I was essentially like, do you have a pulse and need to plan a party? You do? I'm in. So when I got pregnant and had to explain my choices over and over again to well-intentioned family members, it honestly sucked. For the first time in my whole life, I understood that other people didn't agree with the life I'd imagined for myself. They didn't like the idea of a working mom, even though they'd accepted it early on when we needed the money. A couple of years later, when Dave's salary increased enough that it was clear I didn't have to work, the passive-aggressive people around me began to vocalize displeasure outright. Even when you're strong, even when you're committed to your goal, it's hard not to second-guess yourself or take on guilt when it's coming at you from every angle. Open disapproval wasn't enough to make me change my course, but I did stop claiming my course as my own. I wouldn't recognize it until years later, but those opinions begin to wear me down. I was like a piece of glass that gets thrown into the ocean. Other people's opinions became my waves, their judgment the sand I was tossed against over and over until it began to chip away at all my jagged edges. I know that as a society, we tend to think that being smooth and pretty, everything worn off to a soft, rounded edge, is what we should aspire to. But the more I grow and learn and think about it, the more I understand that your jagged edges, the parts of you that stick out in odd directions and don't match everyone else, those are what make you uniquely you. My unique qualities? I am a leader. I am a teacher. I've built two successful companies through hard work and hustle and the wealth of knowledge that can be found from a Google search bar. My goal is simple, even if it's grandiose. I want women to understand that they have the power to change their lives. It's at the core of everything I do. It's the platform I've built everything else on, and I truly believe it's what I was put on this earth to do. I'm building a media empire around the idea. No, I did not misspeak. Yes, I just said a media empire. Not a company, not a side hustle, not a small business, an empire. The world tells me that good girls don't hustle, and they certainly don't stick a flag in the ground and audaciously shout that they want to be a media mogul. They for sure don't feel so passionately about it that they have the word mogul tattooed on their wrist. I know I'm not the only one who has ever bumped up against the expectations of others and then backed down because of them. In a desire to find community, I constantly seek out other women in leadership, and what I find again and again are women doing just what I did. They're downplaying all that they've achieved because they've been taught that it makes others feel uncomfortable. You guys, astounding women are doing this. Women who have built $100 million companies or are running massive teams with unbelievable revenues. Those kinds of women are afraid to admit that they're good at their jobs or that they love what they do. Interacting with them has made me feel less alone, has made me understand that this is something many other women face down. So I'm telling you my story in the hopes that if you're like us, you know there's a tribe of ladies who feel the same way, even if not everyone has found the courage to say it out loud yet. It's okay to want something more for your life. In fact, hang out with me long enough and you'll discover that it's one of the things I value most in people. Drive, hustle, the desire to work as hard as you can to chase down a goal. That's my jam. Hustle is my love language. I love a hustler. I love someone who is unabashed about what they want for their lives and refuses to let anyone talk them out of it. I don't mean that they never feel intimidated by their own audacity. I don't mean that they don't occasionally fall into the trap of other people's opinions. The hustlers I know, they're human, and they face the same insecurities as the rest of us. But when push comes to shove, they don't overthink it or debate it. They just put their heads down and get back to work. That's what hustle means to me. It means that you're willing to work for it, whatever it is, whatever you want, and you don't assume anyone is going to give it to you, but you know it can be yours. Society tends to raise boys to go after what they want, and tends to raise girls to go after the boys. I'm here to tell you that it doesn't matter what society thinks about you or your dreams. Heck, it doesn't matter what your family, your closest friends, or your spouse think about your dreams either. All that really matters is how badly you want those dreams and what you're willing to do to make them happen. Laurel Thatcher Ulrich said, "Well-behaved women seldom make history, and there are hundreds of years of evidence to back her up." Sojourner Truth, Susan B. Anthony, the suffragettes, Marie Curie, Malala Yousafzai, Oprah, Beyonce. Not one of these women put up with the expectations placed on them by society or the time period they were born into. None of them downplayed their gifts, resources, or the access they were given. Those women and so many others like them lived into their God-given strengths and talents regardless of what the world thought of them, sometimes against almost impossible odds and life-threatening oppression. Are you a hustler? Me too. Do you secretly want to be, but you're afraid of what other people might think or say? I've been there. For many women, the weight of other people's opinions will be too big a burden to carry. They won't be able to step outside the safety net because they're too scared. But that's not us. We're willing to go after it. We're willing to be audacious, and we're willing to take it on because the chance to live into our full potential is worth any backlash that comes our way. Some say good girls don't hustle. Well, I'm okay with that. I care more about changing the world than I do about its opinion of me. Part 2. Behaviors to adopt. Behavior. Noun. 1. The way in which one acts or conducts oneself, especially towards others. Good behavior. 2. The way in which an animal or person acts in response to a particular situation or stimulus. Synonyms. Conduct. Deportment. Bearing. Actions. Doings. Your behaviors are the way you act day in and day out. Your behaviors are your habits. They manifest in the actions you take, the words you say, and the way you live your life. What is most important to understand about your behaviors is that they are a choice. They don't feel like a choice because the vast majority of your behaviors are made without conscious thought. They're habits that have ingrained themselves in your life. But they are choices we make, whether consciously or unconsciously, which means every single day you choose to be this person, whether you realize it or not. You choose to believe what you believe and accept what you accept, and these behaviors can either help you immensely or harm you without you ever really knowing it. Now that we've let go of the many excuses that hinder us from pursuing our dreams, we need to take some steps toward them. This section is a list of the behaviors I adopted that helped me get to my goals, and I hope they'll help you do the same. Behavior 1. Stop asking permission. Okay, sisters, I know not everyone is comfortable with the word feminist. As I mentioned earlier, feminist simply means that you believe men and women should have equal rights. But I understand there's a world of other meanings wrapped up in the word for many women, and I'm not trying to convince you otherwise. I only bring it up now because this chapter is going to feel like the most feministy feminist words you've ever heard from me. And if that's not your cup of tea, your inclination is going to be to skip this chapter. Don't skip this chapter. You absolutely don't have to burn your bra in the streets, but you are a grown woman and you owe it to yourself to consider this idea. This chapter is not about men versus women and how we should navigate the disparity. This chapter is about the truth that most cultures have been set up since the beginning of time as patriarchal. This means that in most societies, men have more power, or all the power, and therefore more control. It doesn't matter whether you believe this is good or bad, natural or misguided. Girl, you do you. But for the purposes of this book and chasing down your goals, it matters that you at least consider how this kind of structure might affect your belief in yourself. After all, if you were raised to believe that men know best, that men are the authority, how much faith does that teach you to have in yourself and your opinions as a woman? I was on a business trip recently and stopped by a bookstore in the airport to grab something for the plane. I ended up picking up this incredible book called Women and Power, a manifesto. It's a really interesting study of the history of women speaking publicly. Not women speaking, but women being allowed to, or rather not allowed to, speak in public forums. You should absolutely check it out. It's a rich history and well-written, and you can read it in 2 hours. Personally, I've never really studied, and so therefore never focused on, how little access women were once given to use their voices or offer their opinions. Oh sure, I've read all about the suffragettes and how hard women fought for the right to vote, but I never stopped to consider the long history of pain and torture and even death that happened in the hundreds of years leading up to that time. There is this incredible part in the book that I thought was so powerful. It was the idea that for most of us, the voice of authority in our lives growing up was male. And if we grew up and started working or grew up and married a man, then it's possible that the voice of authority stayed male. The person in charge, the person who told you what to do, who told you what was right and wrong, often was a man. If that man was good and wise and had your best interests at heart, then that might have instilled the belief in you that he knew best. That's powerful enough on its own. But what if that man in your life wasn't good? What if he was hurtful or cruel? What if he had his best interests at heart instead of your own? He was still in charge. He still got to make the decisions, and he still got to affect your life. There's this saying that's been around forever. If you don't see it, how do you know you can be it? If your example of right was always male, do you think it would occur to you naturally that you as a woman have the authority to be whoever and whatever you want to be? Do you think you'd easily come to believe that you have the right and the power and the might to pursue your own dreams just for yourself? Or do you think it's possible that you might seek permission or even approval from people other than yourself because that was your normal? I was raised with a voice of authority that was male. My daddy is a strong and very forceful personality, and he demanded total obedience. I learned to live in hope of his approval and terrified of his displeasure. Then I met my husband when I was 19 years old, and though he is a very different kind of man, I can recognize in retrospect that I transferred my feelings about my father to my husband. I was utterly codependent. I lived every day to please him and make him happy, and if he was unhappy, even if it wasn't about me, it was crippling. I would drown in anxiety until I could do something or say something to change his mood. I remember about 7 years ago, he'd had a bad day at work and he was really frustrated when he got home. I went immediately into fix-it mode. I was like, "Can I make you a drink? Are you hungry? You want to watch a movie? You want to have sex?" He looked at me very firmly but very kindly and said, "Rachel, I'm in a bad mood and I'll get over it. It's okay if I'm upset. You don't have to make it better. It's not your job to make sure I'm happy." Holy crap, you guys. It was a freaking epiphany. It really never occurred to me that I should just let him process his feelings and it wasn't my job to fix them. I had been raised in a house where we did everything possible to keep Daddy happy. And I didn't know there was any other way to be. Consequently, when I began to understand that the entire purpose for my life wasn't to please someone else, I began to consider things I hadn't before. Like, what if I could make decisions for myself? What if I stopped making every choice in my life about what would please others most? What if sometimes I just did what I wanted to do? What if I stopped asking permission? I didn't even realize I was doing it back then, but for the first probably 10 years of my marriage, I had asked Dave's permission to do everything. Not because he had told me to, but because that's what I thought was normal, and I brought it into our marriage with me. "Do you care if I go to the grocery store? Do you mind if I have dinner with Mandy on Thursday night? Hey, is it cool if I eat the last of the Girl Scout cookies? I did this years before we had children, so this wasn't even like a, hey, I want to do this activity and I'm going to need you to cover childcare sort of thing. This was me seriously needing his sanction to do anything in my life because I didn't want my desires to inconvenience him in any way. I look back on those years and I thank God that I married a good man. It would have been so easy for him to take advantage of me or abuse the power he had over me if he had been inclined to. Friends, if you're listening to this, I'm going to assume you're a grown-up woman. Grown-up women don't ask permission. There is absolutely a way to be your own person while also being a part of a great relationship with someone else. It is absolutely possible to manage your priorities, your responsibilities, and your personal desires in a way that stays true to you and the people you love. It happens when you stop asking permission to be yourself. It happens when you stop caring more about what they think of your dream than what you think of your dream. It happens when you put more value into your self-care than you put into whether they'll be inconvenienced by it. You're allowed to want to be your best self, to pursue your dream, even if they don't understand it. You're allowed to push for something more, even if they don't like it. You're allowed to take time away from your kids, even if it's an inconvenience to the person who has to watch them. You're allowed to do something, even if it makes your partner uncomfortable. You're allowed to tell people who you are and what you need instead of first asking if they're all right with it. You're allowed to simply exist without permissions or opinions or qualifiers. I'm trying to recall when I first heard the term girl boss. Certainly, it reached the heights of popularity when Sophia Amoruso published her book. At the time, I lined up to buy it like every other self-respecting, self-taught female entrepreneur. Reading her story was inspiring and motivational, and I honestly didn't give much thought to the title because I was so fired up to read what was inside. But then I started to see the term and the subsequent offshoots everywhere. Hashtag girl boss. Hashtag boss babe. Hashtag entrepreneur. Women of every age and background picked up the moniker and ran with it. It became a popular trend on social media that still hasn't died down years later. It's part of the vernacular now. It's tossed around at conferences and has become a title that young women in entrepreneurial studies programs aspire to. And it makes my blood boil. I want to stand on a soapbox and rant about this particular topic and how it plays into the male voice of authority. But instead, I'll ask a question. Do you know what it means to qualify something? I ask because when I was younger, I don't think I would have stopped to consider the pet name of girl boss for women like me. I would never have questioned what a hashtag might say about women in business in general. When I bring up the act of qualifying something in panel discussions at one conference after another, only a handful of people respond saying they do know about it. And so I read the definition aloud. Qualify. Verb. 1. To modify, limit, or restrict, as by listing expectations or reservations. 2. To make less harsh or severe. Moderate. Before coming to run my company, my husband was a high-level executive at one of the largest media companies on the planet. He led a worldwide team of more people than I can keep track of. He worked his way up from an assistant with drive and determination. He also never, not one single time, had someone give him a label for the work he does based on his gender. To qualify the term boss by adding girl or babe or honey or pink or whatever other ridiculous, antiquated gender role assignment the media thinks is cute this month is at the least disrespectful and at the worst damaging to the way young women view themselves and to our fight for equality in the business world. And the worst part is, women are the ones who are perpetuating this. Women are the ones who are stamping this label on stationery and t-shirts and pinnable quotes, all under the guise that it's helpful and inspiring to a younger generation. On some level, they're right. Owning or running a company or a team is inspiring to a younger generation. But if our daughters have the courage and grit to pick up that baton, don't belittle their efforts by saying it's pretty good for a girl. We don't call them girl doctors, girl lawyers, girl nominees for President of the United States of America. Those positions were hard fought to achieve, and they demand respect. So does this. Being a boss has been one of the greatest privileges and challenges of my life. Being a boss takes guts and tenacity. Being a boss takes hustle and strength. Getting to the level of boss takes hard work, oftentimes harder than it takes for our male counterparts, because in many industries, we're fighting our way into a boys' club. You might call that kind of person a rebel, a rogue, a leader, but there is nothing gender-specific about it. I bring it up now because I want to remind you that you do not need anyone's permission to be yourself, and you also don't need to conform and twist and rebrand your goal to make it more palatable for them. You don't need to present yourself in a certain light to be loved and accepted. The people who deserve to be in your life will care about who you, the real you, actually are, even if it takes some getting used to. Even if you're different from every other woman they know, even if you're different from the woman they fell in love with, be the kind of woman you want to be. Be the kind of woman who is proud of herself. Be the kind of woman who has so much love inside her that she won't be tempted to change herself in order to get love from others. Be the kind of woman who focuses more on being interested than on other people thinking she's interesting. Be the kind of woman who laughs loudly and often. Be the kind of woman who is generous. No matter how much money is in your bank account, you have a wealth of resources to offer others. Be the kind of woman who spends a lifetime learning, because knowledge is power, and those who think they know it all are often the dumbest among us. Be the kind of woman both your 11-year-old self and your 90-year-old self would be proud of. Be the kind of woman who shows up for her life. Be the kind of woman who understands that she was made for more. Be the kind of woman who believes that she is capable of doing amazing things in this world. Be the kind of woman whose own dreams make her nervous, and then go ahead and do them anyway. Be the kind of woman who never asks permission to be herself. Behavior 2. Choose one dream and go all in. Here's the thing I believe about a goal that often annoys people. You can only focus on one at a time. You can only focus on one at a time. If there were a way to put emojis into an audiobook, you better believe there'd be a little aggressive hand clap in between each one of those words. This one is aimed at all my dreamers who are like, I want to author a book, but I'm also a singer-songwriter, and I'm thinking about getting my real estate license, and also I want to work with homeless animals and start a charity to bring endangered species into senior citizen homes to comfort the aged. No. First of all, even if your list isn't quite so elaborate, even if all the things on it support one another, even then, it's not going to be effective. If it were effective, it would have worked already. Secondly, that list isn't one filled with dreams. That is a list filled with some cool ideas. You need to understand the difference. When I say dream, I mean something you greatly desire. I mean that you're fantasizing about something and imagining what it would be like regularly. I mean that when you think about it, your heart beats faster and your palms get sweaty like an Eminem song. Mom's spaghetti. Many people won't get the M&M joke I just made, but that's okay. 3 people did, and as long as someone understands my humor, that's all I care about. Back to the dream versus great idea thing. When people list off the 19 things they're dreaming of, my response is always the same. Which one makes you most excited? If you could choose only one of them to work on for the next decade, which would it be? If only one of them could be successful, which would you choose? The thing is, they always have one. Always. But they surround their single greatest dream with a bunch of great ideas. They list out all sorts of possibilities because that way they can say it's all just for fun. That way their options are endless. That way if chasing the dream becomes too difficult, they can quit and tell themselves it wasn't what they truly wanted anyway. See, if you only pick one dream, there is no plan B. If you want to take the island, burn the boats. If you want to actually achieve your dreams, you can only pursue one at a time. I believe completely in going all in on one single dream. And when you achieve that one, then you can move on to the next. But splitting your attention is splitting your focus and your energy, which means you're not likely to make much progress. When it comes to personal growth, women often approach it like a buffet. They want to work on a little bit of this and a little bit of that. They reason that all the areas of their lives are important, and so they should try to fix them all at once. Maybe that's possible for some people, but I can tell you what's worked for me, in contrast, is focus. I have a whole life outside of the pursuit of my dreams. So do you, I assume. I've got a marriage and children and a career and groceries and dishes and 1,000 other things. I don't have time to waste time. If I'm going to fight for my right to pursue something new for myself, I need it to be as effective as possible. And to be effective, it's got to be totally focused. In the past, whenever I set out to start my diet and my exercise program and finally write my novel, my energy and enthusiasm wouldn't survive the week. There were too many priorities. Too many things to keep track of. I got overwhelmed easily and couldn't keep up with it all. When everything is important, nothing is important. I found success when I learned to focus, and focus requires choosing one thing. It's hard for first-timers to commit to only one area when they're passionate about growth. What they don't realize is that a goal is like a harbor. When the tide rises in the harbor, all the boats rise. This amazing thing happens when you start to grow in one area of your life. Other areas improve with it. If you drop a handful of pebbles into a lake, you'll move the water around a bit. If you drop a boulder into a lake, meaning if you put all your energy into one area, the impact is incredible. The ripple effects of that choice spread out in all directions. For clarity's sake, I'd like to mention that it's very possible to grow in multiple areas of your life once you've achieved success in one area and established it as a habit. For instance, I am able to maintain my health and fitness regimen while pursuing a new goal because health and fitness are habits in my life now. But if I had tried to conquer them simultaneously, or attempted to take them on while starting my company, let's say, I wouldn't have been successful. The question then becomes, how do you decide? How do you pick the right thing to focus on next? Well, if you're me, you narrow it down using a process I like to call 10-10-1. If you've never heard of 10-10-1 before, that's because I made it up. But I did trademark it because it's a good idea and I'm not a dummy. Like most things in life, I figure out a process that works for me, and when pressed to explain it, I write it out and give it a snappy title. See, my entire publishing career. 10 years. 10 dreams. 1 goal. Who do you want to be in 10 years? What are the 10 dreams that would make that a reality for you? Which one of those dreams are you going to turn into a goal and focus on next? 10, 10, 1. Let's look at it a bit more closely together. 10 years. I like to encourage people to start by closing their eyes and imagining the best version of themselves. Imagine that a decade of time has gone by and you are living your best possible ideal for yourself and your life. Dream big. Don't put any restrictions on it. Don't overthink it. Just allow yourself to envision the most magnificent possible future version of yourself. A decade in the future. What is the very best version of yourself doing? What does she look like? How does she go about her day? How does she speak to people she loves? How is she loved in return? What kind of clothes does she wear? What kind of car does she drive? Is she a great cook? Does she love to read? Does she love to run? Get as specific as you possibly can. Where do you go on vacation? What's your favorite restaurant to eat at now that your life is different? What kind of food do you consume? What does it feel like to go throughout your day? Are you optimistic? Are you encouraging to others? After a decade of working on yourself and growing as a woman, how much joy is there in your life? Who's in your life? What's your week like? How do you treat people? How do they treat you? Just let your dreams run absolutely wild. Are you happy? Are you energetic? Are you driven? Do you feel ambitious? What's your relationship like with your family members? Do you own a home? And what does it look like? Do you have kids? Do you have a family? Are you married? What's the best of the best? Now, go bigger. What's a bigger version of the best version of you? Living every day in the best state that you know how to be. What do you do for work? What is the highest value that your future self holds? Is it family? Is it loyalty? Is it growth? Be as specific as you can be. Now, without a second of judgment or overthinking it, I want you to write down everything that you just thought of as fast as you can. I don't want you to forget any of it. I want that future version of you to be seared inside your brain. The best version of me is when I'm at my best, I don't hold back. This is not the time to think it through or tell yourself to slow down. This is not the time for realistic. This is the time to think as big as you can possibly go. Hopefully, this exercise helped you paint a clear picture in your mind of a lot of different awesome things your future self can take part in. Personally, I like to do this once or twice a year and create a vision board, like in fifth grade when you glue a bunch of magazine clippings to poster paper. So I've got a visual to go along with my mental imagery. That is the first step. That's you in 10 years. Now, here's how you narrow it down. 10 dreams. Turn your 10 years into 10 dreams. If those 10 dreams came true, they would make your vision a reality. So if you saw a future that was completely financially free, maybe your dreams would be things like making a six-figure salary, being completely debt-free, etc. But maybe your future dream self is also healthy and happy and energetic. Add becoming a marathon runner and a vegetarian to the mix. The important thing is, again, to be specific. The list of dreams is how that future vision manifests for you. Often when we do this, we come up with more than 10, but it's essential to narrow it down. Focus matters, remember? Choose 10 dreams that, if they were to come true, would make your future self real. Now, here's the key. Write down those 10 dreams in a notebook every single day and write them as if they've already happened. I do this every day of my life because I want the repetition to instill in my head and my heart where my focus should be. I want to remind myself who I should be. I write them as if they've already happened because I read somewhere once that your subconscious focuses on what you give it. If you tell yourself and your subconscious, "I'm going to make $1 million," you don't end up focusing on the goal, but on the words "going to." It becomes like a to-do list for your brain. You didn't give it direction. You didn't ask your mind to help you figure out how. You only told it that you were going to do something, which isn't especially powerful no matter how big a goal you set for yourself, because you create to-do lists all the time. What makes this something your brain should take notice of? What if, instead, you told yourself, "I have $1 million in the bank"? That's specific. That's an outcome. That's a direction to head. Going to is something in the future. Have is present tense, which means your subconscious starts focusing on how to make that real right now. I don't actually have $1 million in the bank yet, but I'm working on it. Some items on my list are things that I want to achieve. Other items are things I can accomplish every day. I am an exceptional wife. That one is on my list. I write it down every day as a reminder of who I am and who I want to be. When I imagine my future best self, she's still drunk in love with Dave Hollis. In the future, he's still my best friend, and we still can't keep our hands off each other. Only now we look so much fresher because all our kids are older and we don't have to change diapers or wake up with a teething baby. I'm careful with the words I write down, too. I don't use the word good. I don't use the word great. I use the word exceptional. When I write that sentence about being an exceptional wife every day, I have to ask myself what I did today that made me exceptional. It's a simple prompt to move me into action. It reminds me to text my husband and tell him how hot he looked in those pants, or how much I love and appreciate him. That wouldn't happen if I didn't have the prompt reminding me who I want to be. Another item on my daily list is kind of obnoxious, but hey, it's my dream list, not yours. I write down, "I only fly first class." If you follow me on social media, you may have some idea of how often I travel for work. It's a lot, you guys. A lot. I don't mind the travel because 90% of the time I'm on the road to give a keynote speech or motivate a bunch of conference attendees with my unique lyrical stylings and the energy of a Springer Spaniel. Public speaking is one of my favorite parts of my job, but it also requires focus and energy. It's hard to have either when you're shuffling back and forth across the country on planes. And it's hard to keep up with my current workload so that I can make all those speaking engagements when I'm sitting in coach. Also, my current workload always involves writing. I'm either writing a book or editing a book or working on an article or a post. And because it's me and I don't know the meaning of the word private, almost everything I write tends to be sensitive in nature. Do you know how weird it is to write a chapter on your sex life while a rando guy sits next to you sharing the armrest? I do. I've written on planes for years. There's no other way for me to turn these suckers in on time. And I hate not writing simply because I'm worried about what my neighbor thinks of chapter 5. That's where this dream comes into play. In my mind, first class is good for one single thing: seat size. I don't care about their weird entrees. I don't care about the free wine. I don't even care about the ability to get on the plane before everyone else. All I care about is that in first class, I can sit crisscross applesauce with this computer in my lap. It's so comfortable. It's so far away from the next nearest person. It's the best. I know this because one time, years ago, Dave used his miles to upgrade me on a flight. Once I got a taste of the promised land, I couldn't stop dreaming about it. So I wrote the words, "I only fly first class," every day. for months and months, which means that every day my brain accepted that as truth and helped to make that dream a reality for me. When I first started writing it on my list, we didn't have that kind of money in our travel budget at work. And just because I wanted it to be true didn't make it so. But after writing it down for 6 months, I had an epiphany so deep.